No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, a grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Together with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a conversation about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR, and we'll be glad to answer them, I hope. Anyway, Maria, are you there?
I'm here. Good evening. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, first of all, because I got to go to a Maryland football game yesterday. Maryland's my alma mater, and I got to see them score 63 points in the Big Ten.
What?
Yes,
Yes,
I was absolutely astounded. They beat the University of Illinois by more than 30 points. So it was a fun game. It was high scoring, and it was great. And of course, now they have to come up against Michigan State, and Ohio State. So it may be the last game they win for a while. And
my
I'm
God.
Glad that I was there. And the Los Angeles Dodgers are hanging in there, Maria. They're your guys, right?
Yeah, I grew up blue because of I was born and raised in Los Angeles, but the Lakers were, and the Los Angeles Rams particularly, were really who I cared about. But of course, it's Los Angeles, so how can I not?
Yeah, of course. And what happened to the Rams? Where are they these days?
They're undefeated in the NFL in Los Angeles, where they belong.
Is that right? They're back in Los Angeles?
Yeah, this is their second season back. And literally, their headquarters and their coach and their practice facility are within a stone's throw from where I live.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have them back. I still haven't gotten to full fan status yet because they left me for 7 years. So, we have time to recover.
Well, my poor old Washington team is doing well too. They're at the top of the top of the division. They beat Dallas and they beat New York. They're two nemesis. So we're on a roll.
Oh, goodness, I would say.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. But they have a great penchant for letting you down just when you think, And I've got some diehard friends who at the end of the season, they're doing all the calculations. If this team drops out and that other team, and these four, we could get the wild card spot.
Yes.
So hopefully we're not going to do that this year.
Yes.
But today we have a special guest. This man is a great guy. And before I bring him on, I want to personally say something about him. He is a DNC member, and I don't know if people know this, but the DNC and the RNC are actually made up of people who are elected and appointed to represent their parties nationwide. And this is Earl Foulkes, and Earl was instrumental in a couple years ago in getting a resolution passed that recognized our delegation and recognized the issue of statehood. Before the Democratic Committee, we had been left out of the platform the convention before, so he's a really, really strong statehood supporter, and we love him for that. But also, he is. We're going to talk today about gay and lesbian rights. He is the president and chief executive of the Center for Black Equity. He was previously, for 15 years, the executive director of the D.C. Comprehensive AIDS Resource and Education Consortium. And he, in 2014, he was elected president of the Gertrude Stein Democratic Club, which is the LGBT community's democratic club here in Washington. They're very important. Everybody goes before them to seek their endorsement. Actually, in the primary, they gave their endorsement to my competitor, but I forgive them.
I guess so.
They're a great organization, and Earl is a great leader. And so we're happy to have him on the show today. Earl, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on our show today. And like I said, you've done so many great things for the people of Washington, D.C., and we're really happy to have you. And the first thing we'd like to talk about, Earl, and I'd like to have your impressions of this, and please meet my co-host, Maria Sanchez.
Good afternoon. Good evening, Earl.
That the New York Times reported that current administration, the Trump administration, is considering narrowing the definition of gender as a biological immutable condition determined by genitalia at birth. And this is going to roll back a series of decisions made by the Obama administration, which loosened the concept of gender, in federal programs, including in education and healthcare, and recognizing gender largely as an individual's choice. Now, let me first ask you, how do you feel about this? How important do you think this is?
Well, you know, over the course of my work in social work and my political work, I've gotten to work with the transgender, very closely with transgender men and women. And this impacts me very, very deeply, because when I was growing up, I had a great uncle who would be what you would call, in today's terms, gender nonconforming. Mm-hmm. And he was grew up in a very rough neighborhood in New Jersey, in Camden, New Jersey, but he had eight great uncles who played football, and no one ever bothered him. But, you know, I've always been sensitive to people who are different. And what happens is that if this comes to pass, even in a limited form, it basically erases the 2 million transgender individuals who live in two million transgender Americans, who many of them who have served our country, many of them who are elected officials. It's egregious to narrow our form of democracy and representative government and eliminate people. We should be broadening the who we recognize as people, as opposed to eliminating it. And to define someone based on their birth certificate is basically unfair and it's cruel, in my opinion.
So, Earl, I agree with you, and I couldn't agree with you more. Can you talk more about what life was like for your uncle, and what did that mean to be gender nonspecific? Because now we call it non-binary, right?
Right, that's correct. That's the new word. I'm sometimes a little bit behind in my words. My phrases, I have to keep up. But
most people don't know that. That's why I said it. But I want to know what it looked like to you and to him, because that was a long time ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Part of some of the work that I do, besides all the other things that I'm supposed to do, is the Center for Black Equity. We're the umbrella organization of about 60 LGBTQ black pride organizations around the world, 50 of them in the United States. And as a result, I've got to travel to a lot of different cities and meet a lot of older LGBTQ African-Americans who have been around for many years, and they describe the community. And for my great uncle, there was an underground community. There were parties and social events that took place. He told me that you usually knew if the light was purple in someone's basement, that was where the party was going to be. And it was a safety zone, much the way black prides are safety spaces now. And in those days, it was about surviving. It was about creating a skill set that you could make a living. And he did hair, and he did design clothes for the local people. And also, it was about surviving and being in a safe place. And you identified people who were like you. And then fortunately for him, he had big brothers who took care of him, protected him, so he was never harmed. But there was always the danger if you went outside of your community that something could happen to you, where you didn't have the protection, and then neighbors didn't know or fear your siblings. But it was, you had to be very, very, very cautious. I remember Uncle Tim, there was no hiding the fact that he was gay. I always remember he was just very gay, and I didn't know what gay meant, but I knew what Uncle Tim was. But he never complained. He was so grateful to survive. And a lot of the older LGBT people that I've met who are older than me, who lived in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, and I met some people who've been in those times, they're so grateful to have survived. And they rejoice every day that they're able to survive. And they're amazed at how the great strides have taken place over the last 20 years for LGBTQ Americans, despite the homophobia in our communities and sometimes racism and ageism and all the other things that people have to deal with. Most seniors that I met who are LGBTQ look very positively at their experience of growing up as being different.
Wow.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I really relate to that somewhat, Earl, because I grew up in North New Jersey, which, you know, is much like Camden. I had an older brother who was a football player and protected me. And, you know, and I was a conformist, so I understand that. And you know, till this day, I say to my gay cousin, Jeffrey, how much I respect him. Because when we were kids, Jeffrey hated sports, and I hated sports. But I played every sport. I played every sport. I just sucked. I just sucked at all of them. You know, I mean, I was a kid that you know, what they put in the game for one inning if his mother showed up, you know, I was just absolutely terrible. But I did it because that's what they expected little boys to do, and I was a conformist. And Jeffrey and I actually used to put on plays. We thought of ourselves as great thespians when we were little kids, and we would put on plays for our family, and they would laugh hysterically at us because we were little kids trying to do Shakespeare, and we would always walk off the stage indignantly, like, you know, what's wrong with these people? Can't they see that we're serious actors? But anyway, I relate to that because I conform to all those things, and that's why I did it, because I wanted to be accepted. So I admire people that have the great courage to be exactly who they are. And that's one of the things that bothers me about this. And one of the things that scares me about it is that it's only 2 million people. And so they have the same problem we have in the district, I think, is only 700,000 people. It's hard to stand up against 350 million people when you're in the minority. So I worry about what's going to happen to these people. But let me ask you something. Do you think this is part of a larger agenda?
Well, you know, I think that 2 years ago when the general election took place, I think that the current administration, Donald Trump and those people running under his label, were very clear about their agenda. Nothing that's happening now should be a surprise to anybody. And people who decide they didn't like the process of how the Democrats chose their candidates, or they didn't like the candidates, or they, for some personal reason, or they didn't like her personality or whatever, and decided not to vote, they basically did vote. And they voted for this man who has been very consistent about the things he's going to do. He and his party, they said that they were going to undo everything that Obama did, everything. And they were very clear. And they've done that. And people are I can't believe that they're trying to erase transgenders, and I can't believe that they are you know, that he's cronies with dictators and fascists, and that he's separating babies at the border from their mothers and fathers. This shouldn't be. I'm not surprised at all. He's been very consistent, and what people don't understand is that, and I've understand because I've been traveling around the country for the Democratic National Committee to help elect candidates who will support statehood and transgender rights, and those things are very important to me. What people don't understand is that this man, his base is, if he ran today, 45% of Americans, unfortunately, will support him. He just has to get 6%.
Well, and I think that's one thing, because you're a DNC member, let me say this. This is one thing that the Democrats still don't get. They still think every excuse that you just put out there, I hear over and over again. We really won, you know, we really won because Hillary got the most votes. Look, we know how the Electoral College works.
Right.
We just haven't gotten it to our heads that a lot of this stuff is stuff that America wants. And the Democrats have to deal with that, I think. Go ahead, Maria. You're a good Republican. Tell us what you think.
Well, I'm a rogue renegade Republican.
I know you are.
Yeah, I mean, literally, I'm so liberal socially, it's obscene. But what I would like to say, and Earl, I think you alluded to this basically, is 2 years ago, we had an opportunity to make a decision, and the people chose.
Yeah, right.
Within 10 days, we have another opportunity to make decisions, and you cannot weigh in unless you vote. And now I know it's too late to register to vote, so it's a moot point for those who haven't. But if you are registered, then it's imperative that your voice be heard. And I am going to be so curious because Michael, the senator, and I have been talking for the last 2 years that the Democrats, in addition to their indignation, it's been about resisting. But what is it today? What's right. The mandate? What is the message? What is the call to action? I'm not hearing it.
Me either. And well, I think that's a problem. Go ahead, Earl.
Well, you know, I would say that that's partially true. And I said, but full disclosure, there was a time in my life growing up in the southeastern Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area, where I was a card-carrying Republican. There are a lot of African-Americans who were Republicans, and I am a part of my family was one of those branches of Republicans, and I remained Republican for longer than I probably should have. But the Republican Party was a different kind of party. It wasn't all one way. It was, you could be a liberal, you could be a progressive, you could be a moderate.
Correct.
And if it wasn't
yeah.
for the Republican Party, we wouldn't have civil rights. So
right.
So that, I just want to make that clear. I would say that the focus for the Democratic Party is a little different. The DNC, we're looking at more local issues. Elections are not decided by people, caravans of people approaching the U.S. border. That's not what people vote. People vote their pocketbooks. They vote for local taxes. They vote education. They vote health care. The campaigns that I participated in Wisconsin and Georgia and Nevada and New York, those were the issues people were talking about. And I think that these big overriding slogans, these catch-all phrases that here the four were thrown out at people, never resonated with people. And people are interested in what's going on locally. People wanted the school system, their health access to affordable health care and housing. That's what people want to talk about. They don't want to talk about, North Korea. They're not talking about those things. They're not talking about tariff increases, unless you're a farmer. No one is talking about those things. We're talking, the cost of gasoline, the cost of bread. That's what people are talking about, and that's what the Democratic Party, the roots of the party, is really focusing on the local issues, which is why we have what we used to call the Big Tent, because you could be from all over the country and still have different competing interests but still support your local candidate because he was reflecting those issues that are important locally.
Well, you know, first of all, what you just said, that Tip O'Neill used to say that all the time, right? That all politics
right, that's right.
And just so people know, there were many African Americans that were Republicans, because a lot of those guys standing in the doorways of schools and keeping African Americans segregated in the South were Democrats. And, you know, until this day, when I say that Martin Luther King Jr. was a Republican, young people look at me like I'm crazy. But
of course, his father was definitely a Republican.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Daddy King. I worry somewhat, Earl, that the Democrats really don't get this. Do you think they are getting this? I think they're still stuck on the big issues, and they're out there preaching, they're not being specific enough for people. And I think you're absolutely right. One of the problems that we have with statehood is that everybody agrees with us. Everybody says, oh, yeah, sure, you should be equal. But nobody focuses on it, because you're right. They care about the price of gasoline. They care about getting decent educations for their kids. They care about crime. They care about local issues. So do you think we're really getting that as Democrats?
Well, you know, this is something that I wrestle with. And I know, and I want to thank Senator Brown for coming to a candidates forum in the building, in the apartment complex that I live in. And someone raised the issue about when the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate, and we had a Democratic president, right, and statehood was not an issue. And yeah. I think Senator Brown was very gracious to the guy. And the reality is, the reason why statehood is not an issue when the Democrats controlled the House and controlled the Senate and controlled the presidency, it's because it was not a priority. The fact of the matter is that the president and his administration they were not willing to use political capital, a very limited amount of political capital, to push through statehood. They focused on affordable health care. And they thought that they didn't have enough political capital to push more than one major initiative. And that was not necessarily true. The problem with only focusing on the affordable health care is that the Democrats didn't go and sell that. And the Tea Party Republicans controlled the narrative and put the Democrats on the defensive, and we lost the House and Senate. And the fact of the matter is that for statehood to pass, there can always be some overriding national issues. But statehood, the way it needs to be translated is that there are 700,000 Americans. We're not living in Guam. They're Americans too, but we're the capitals here. We're right here. But we don't have rights. And I don't think the people, I don't think that message is being told effectively on the local level. We need to have, and one of the things that I do personally is I support people who support statehood and around the country as to the extent that I'm able to do financially and through the DNC, because I understand the importance. And I asked Canada, do you support DC statehood? And if it came up, would you vote for DC statehood? And I said, good, then I can support you, and I'll actually participate in your fundraiser, and I'll come out to support, your efforts. Because I think we have to start asking, not the Congress always and senators, we need to be approaching state legislators. Yep. We need to be speaking to governors. We need to be speaking to attorney generals. We need to be talking to those gatekeepers and opinion holders in those states. And it's a heavy lift. But ultimately, the message gets down beyond the Washington, because when you're only talking to senators and House members, it's very limited. The average person is not going to get that message.
That's so well said, because...
Yeah, it really is.
When Alaska became a state in Hawaii, too, what was the population? Does anybody know?
They were very small.
Yeah, they were small.
And so that's what I'm thinking, Earl, based on what you said, is... It's not about the 700,000 people in the District of Columbia. It's really about Americans.
Right.
And what I don't understand is the pacificity that seems to consume the residents of the District of Columbia, because I think if they would take it up and on again, that it would get more noise and the narrative would be shared. But everybody seems to be resigned, almost like the Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly is that we have these you know, rallies and 100 people show up and they're always the same 100 people. I mean, we know who they are, you know, and it's funny that we had this great, after the thing at Stoneman Douglas, this handful of kids put together a rally, and we had a rally that was adjacent to them, and we ended up with, you know, maybe 150 people, and they generated 800,000 people on the mall in a few days. Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely amazing to me. And yeah, there is a I don't know if you want to call it an acquiescence to this.
Or apathy.
Or apathy, yeah, to this. And we really need to do more locally to generate.
You know, I want to try to address some of that apathy, because I've been living in the district. I'm not a native Washingtonian. I'm a native Philadelphian, and go Eagles. and so I throw that in there.
That's the next hurdle for us, you know, is the Eagles.
Yes, I know. I know the two games coming up.
With the background of your profile.
Right. I've been here 22 years, going on 23 years, and I've seen D.C. change a great deal. And I've gotten to know my city council member, because that's how I grew up. I was taught that you can have a direct line to your elected officials. And so I've done that, and I have no problems with something I don't see. In Ward 6, I'll call Charles Allen. If there's something nationally, I have Senator Brown, I have Eleanor Holmes Norton, and we have you know, I'm connected. I think what's going on in the district is a little bit, it's partly apathy. Sometimes things can go so well that you take things for granted. When I moved to D.C., it was not the place a lot of people were moving to. It was high crime. The city was the federal government was about to take over the finances. The schools were in disarray. The police were in disarray. The fire department was in disarray. The sanitation was in disarray. It was in the lame duck administration for Marion Barry. Things were just going, everything was disarray. And people were, and the government was interfering a lot more. People were feeling very sensitive about that. Things are going well. We have the economy for many people are booming. Housing is still high, but people are moving in, thanks to, the tens of thousands of dollars generated by the Homeland Security after 9/11. People are coming in with six-figure incomes. People are moving from all over the country. First of all, we have a lot of people with divided loyalties. Many people who live here are going to go back home and aren't invested in D.C. And the other half are doing very well. And, like, why mess up things if we're doing, you know, D.C. is thriving. New restaurants and new neighborhoods. And I think people are comfortable. People are too comfortable.
Well, that's interesting that we're victims of our own success. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And you're right. You know, I was just, as you said today, at the forum in your building, as I'm driving home along the waterfront in Ward 6, where I used to go buy all my, you know, crabs at $35 a bushel. I didn't recognize it. You know, it's changed so dramatically. And the little arena stage that, you know, was our local theater where we just had an event there last week. And now it's this big, beautiful, sprawling complex where I've been told.
Three-story complex.
Yeah, and you know what? I was told that they have a state by a guy from Hollywood. I was told that they have a state-of-the-art production facility that rivals the very best in the world. So you're right. You know, I moved here 50 years ago, and it was a sleepy little southern town. And, you know, one of the things that we loved about living in Newark, New Jersey, is we were right across the river from Manhattan. And we used to go to the theater a lot. My mother was a theater person. And when we moved here, I remember being a teenager and going to the theater with my sister, and we used to come out of the theater at 10 o'clock and there was no place to eat. There was not a restaurant in Washington, D.C. that was opened after 10 o'clock. And we couldn't believe this because, you know, in Manhattan, I mean, you could eat 24 hours
a day.
Yeah. And so all that, it was kind of a sleepy little southern town, and it really has transformed over the years. So that's really a good point. I think that combined with the fact that what you said earlier, we care about our kids' schooling, we care about the potholes, we care about the crime, we care about the more egocentric kind of issues, the things that affect our lives every day, than we do about the big issues. And statehood is like world peace. If you ask people if they believe in world peace, they always say yes. But, you know, it's different in what you believe and what you're actually trying to work towards achieving. So I think that's a very good point. Let me ask you another question. I mean, the last 72 hours or a little more than that, 4 days now, has just seen a horrible, horrible series of events. 11 Jews killed in a synagogue in Pittsburgh and many more wounded. Two African Americans shot to death because some nut couldn't get into a black church, so he just went out looking for black people and found the two nearest black people he could kill. And letter bombs going all over the United States to people that have differing political opinions. What do you have to say? I really would love your impressions of this kind of stuff. Earl, are we changing? Has the political divisiveness gone so far that this is going to become the new normal?
You know, this has become the new normal. I didn't know about the, I was in a meeting yesterday morning, yesterday afternoon, and I didn't notice that the message about the 11 people killed in the synagogue in Squirrel Hill section of Pittsburgh, which I'm familiar with. I know the synagogue. I passed the synagogue before, and the bombs and the two people in Kentucky, and I know that part of Kentucky where people were killed.
Yeah.
This has become, you know, it used to be a time in our, and I'm not a young guy. And I can remember when schools were safe, movies were safe, synagogues were safe, churches were safe. Yep. There were safe spaces, even in the worst possible neighborhood.
Yeah, even in Newark.
In Newark, and I lived in Jersey City and lived in New York, so I know Newark, and I had an uncle in East Orange, and so I'm very familiar with it.
East Orange, yeah.
There were places you could go to, and you were taught, if something happens, you go to this place.
Right.
There are safety zones. We don't have any safety zones. We don't have one politically anymore. There's nothing that says moderate. There's no moderation. You're conservative, reactionary Republican, or you're a very liberal progressive Democrat. And there's no in between. There's no place. You're one extreme to the other. We've become a culture of extremism and instant gratification, thanks to the internet and thanks to the social media. We want to feel, when we feel something, we want to express it immediately, whether it's good or bad. And I think that's the kind of society we live in. Is people used to wait. If you didn't like your politician, you waited until 4 years or 2 years, and you voted. You know, you didn't need term limits. The voters were term limits. You didn't try to blow up the people you don't like or shoot the people you like. You voted them out, and you waited, or you moved to a neighborhood where you could feel comfortable in. Now it's just like, if you feel something, you have to express it, and if people don't listen, you become violent. And, you know, my brother lives in Georgia, and he has guns. He hunts. He has rifle. I don't think I would eat anything he shot, but he's a hunter. And he was always a hunter. And we've always had guns. You know, guns is not a new thing. We've always had rifles and guns and stuff. That's my grandpa used to go hunting. So it was not unusual. But we didn't have AK-47s or whatever they are. We didn't have automatic weapons. We were not going to go and invade Cuba. I mean, you know, we don't, this whole thing that you have these weapons where you can shoot up and kill hundreds of people, what happened in Las Vegas and what happened in Pulse, until we acknowledge the fact that we have a lot of people who need help and devise, and it's one thing to say that someone has a mental illness. And as a politician and as a clinician, I know that you all know that it costs a lot of money to take care of people who have mental illness. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of staff. It takes a lot of money to monitor these people. So it's one thing to say that people need help, but as a society, are we willing to make the investment to handle all the mental illness that's going on in our society? You know, we want it both ways. And the fact of the matter is...
Earl, I think you've touched on the bigger point. I don't think it's that we're so polarized, even though it looks like it, and that we are becoming more extreme. I do think that it boils down to mental health and the lack thereof. And it, and like you said about the guns, my dad was a proud card-carrying member of the NRA. I grew up with guns. He taught us to shoot and to respect a gun. I've never owned one, but I was raised with them. And I think that was the norm. And my dad was a hunter, too. It wasn't just a sport. He shot for us to eat. But I think that that's really the issue, is when we... rightfully so, we stopped with the institutionalizing of the mentally ill, but then we did nothing to take care of them. We let them fall onto the streets, and that's where no well person kills themselves and no well person kills another. And it doesn't have anything to do with politics.
Right.
Yeah,
this
and
is,
you know what?
Society.
But the one thing that, you know, I want to take responsibility for as a Democrat, and I'm a proud Democrat. I believe in the Democratic Party. But here's a problem that I think we have, too. And, you know, Earl talked about his family having guns. I grew up around guns my whole life. I mean, I had access to them. My friends, I grew up in a working class neighborhood. They had access to guns. I hunted when I was a young man. But I never thought about going into my high school and killing everybody because Susie wouldn't go to the prom with me. You know, I mean, I think that's a whole new thing. But I think as Democrats, we don't say what you and Earl just said. We say, you don't want a gun. You just don't realize it. Let us explain it to you. Instead of sitting down at a table and saying, okay, guns do have legitimate uses. It really is a mental health issue because we've always had guns and we need to address this. We don't need AR-15 rifles out on the street, but we also don't need to ban every gun to keep people safe. Oh, and I need to point one thing out that Maria said earlier. In Washington, D.C., if you're listening, we have same-day voter registration.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes, we do.
All the way.
You can.
In California, we have a limit.
Wow, I can't believe that, because you guys, I thought you had everything in California.
including the most signers to the D.C. for statehood petition.
Most members of Congress who have signed on, yes. To California.
Pardon me.
But that's only because you want to make San Diego its own state.
Actually, it's on the ballot to divide us into three states.
I know, and I've seen the map. It's
ugly.
Astounding. Yeah. It really is. So, I think that, you know, it's been my pet peeve since I've been a member of the Democratic Party, and I was a staff person at the DNC for 4 years, and I was a consultant there for 21 years, and it's always been one of my pet peeves that we tend to talk down to America, and I think we need to stop that. I think we need to do exactly what Earl's talking about doing, going out. You know, our next presidential candidate better be buying a bus and getting on it soon and traveling across America and talking to Americans. I think that's really important.
Well, and Michael,
if I may, yeah. One of the problems that the party has, and it's Tom Perez is working hard to develop a kind of similar Governor Dean's 50-state strategy. The fact of the matter is that guns are important if you live in the Dakotas, you live in West Virginia, you live in many states in this country. When you talk about banning guns and putting gun controls, you're talking, you limit your appeal to a lot of the public and a lot of voters. You know, guns aren't bad. People who use them in the wrong way are the problem. And I think that when the Democratic Party starts nominating and pushing for candidates who reflect local values and not always, we have to be willing to compromise. Not everyone. I believe in women's reproductive rights. But if I were a staunch Catholic and that my faith said that, you know, abortion I don't agree with that. But I agree with you on 10 other things, but on that one thing I disagree with you, and you're going to throw me aside because of one thing? That's not smart. That's not smart politics.
Well, I actually agree 100% with you there as well, Earl. I think that we need to start the Earl Folks for President campaign. I've said that for years, you know. I believe in a woman's right to choose, but I also understand why people have a problem with it. I do.
Right.
You know, I don't agree with them, but I understand that. And I know that that's a litmus test. When I was in college, in graduate school, I studied the Equal Rights Amendment because that was the big issue of the day when I was in graduate school. And in fact, it's still an issue. It hasn't passed yet.
It still hasn't passed.
I know.
It's been dormant for 30 years.
Two states short still. But. You know, I understand that, you know, national organization didn't want to talk to you if you didn't believe in a woman's right to choose, you know. And I had a very dear fundamentalist Christian friend who believed in a equal pay for equal work, believed, you know, in all sorts of things that the National Organization of Women believed in. But she didn't believe in that. And they told her to pound sand. We don't need you. And you know, I think that's a mistake we make sometimes. We need to get back to being a big tent.
We don't do abortions in our family. I you know, that's just something that we've had several situations. And terminating the pregnancy was not an option. And that has to be respected.
Not for us either. My wife had amniocentesis because she was older when she had her third child, and we discussed it, and we made the same decision. If things came back and didn't look the way, you know, they should look, that we would carry the pregnancy through. We agree with that. But we're both staunch supporters of a woman's right to choose.
It should be up to
women. And Maria too. Yes.
When I had my amnio with my fourth child, my husband, who was Jewish, he was like, what are you going to do? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, what are we going to do with the information? I said, we're going to inform the three sons that we have that we will have a child that has some challenges. And we will let them know that before she's born, because we found out her gender too, if that's the case. It was never ever a consideration of termination, but I too support a woman's right to choose. It's my uterus. I make my choices. I want another woman to have that liberty, regardless of how she chooses.
Well, that's wait true. A second. Your baby is a girl. The youngest is a girl.
Yeah, I have three sons.
Oh boy, she must be spoiled. She must be spoiled. I'm with three older brothers.
They used to call her Bebe.
Oh yeah.
She's very
well protected. And she's well protected. Yeah,
she is. And she loves men as much as I do, because that's all she knew was brothers. She never called them my brothers. She always called them brothers. Brothers won't let me, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, because they're protective of you. Brothers won't let me, blah, blah, blah. I was like, yeah, I know. They were the second parent in the household.
Well, you know,
that's good.
Earl, you talked about knowing East Orange, you know, New Jersey. And my sister was at the Behringer. I always tell this story that she was in the Behringer East Orange football game, which when I was a kid in the 1950s, they used to say they bet $1 million on that game. Illegal. Oh. But the Behringer East Orange game, she was injured during the Behringer East Orange game. And everybody says, your sister played on the football team? No, she was in the marching band. And somebody from East Orange hit her in the head with a brick. They threw bricks at the band when they came onto the field. And that's how tough those areas were. I mean, they really
they were hardcore. We were afraid to spend them. We were soft. We were from Philadelphia. We were from outside Philadelphia. We were soft. We were afraid to spend too much time up there. You have to be hardy.
Well, I've gotten soft over the years. I was in Camden not long ago, and I thought, wow. You know, I said to my sister when she was alive, I went up there, and I said, New Jersey has changed. And she said, no, it hasn't. You have. You know, same as it's been, but you've changed. So we're getting close to the end of our time here, Earl. Is there anything that you want to talk about that we haven't talked about? Is there anything that you want to say, especially as somebody that's connected to the Democratic National Committee? You know, is there anything and that's going out in the country? Let me tell you something about I've been out campaigning all week. As you know, they have early voting here, Earl. And early voting is up. It's up. It looks like it may be up by more than 100%. So people are coming out and vote.
So you can literally, because in California you can mail in early, but you can't go to a polling place and vote. You can literally physically go somewhere to vote.
We have 17 early voting locations.
Wow.
I voted on Tuesday, I think. I voted early.
Do you get to vote early and vote often?
Well, that's only in New Jersey.
not supposed to do that. But
only in Atlantic City you can do that.
Well, you can vote, Maria, you can vote until Friday. And then and they're open from 8:30 in the morning till 7. So you can vote, and you can vote anywhere. In other words, there's one in my neighborhood, and there's one in Earl's neighborhood. But if I was in Earl's neighborhood, let's say I worked there, I could go into his voting place and vote. You can vote anywhere at any early voting place, anywhere in the city. And then after Friday, they shut down until Election Day, which is a week from Tuesday, and then you would have to vote in your precinct if you vote on Election Day. But other than that, you can vote anywhere in the city. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's tough.
It is awesome. The sad thing, I have to say something about that. I think that's very cutting edge, very California-like, and it's very progressive. The problem is, in the last primary, we had some wards where only 19% of the electorate voted, right. And we had the ballot initiative about tipped employees that was passed, but it was passed by a minority of a minority of a minority of voters, and it was overturned by the city council. I think that we need to go back to doing more. I want to see the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, too. I want to get back to civics. When I was a kid, voting, I went with my grandmother, and I'm going to divulge my age by saying what election I was. And when she went to vote for Kennedy, and I was a little boy, she went and she taught me, and I was wondering why we were going back to elementary school when the schools were closed for the day. Because it was, you know, back in the day, Election Day was a holiday. Right. And I knew we didn't have to go to school, and she was taking me back to school, and I was a little confused. But she was explaining this whole thing called voting. And she made me promise that I would vote, and I missed one election of the many elections that I participated in. I only missed one, the school board election in my town. But I think we need to get back to civics, and we need to really explain. We assume that people understand what voting means and the whole concept of voting in elections and representation and access to your politicians. We don't teach that in school anymore. We haven't taught that in school for a long time. So people don't know. People are growing up and not understanding what their civic duty means. And I think we need to get back to publicly educating people what voting means and what civic duty means and what running for office means. And we need to stop assuming that everyone knows this and people is just being apathetic. People don't understand. And we should always remind people of what it means to be in a representative form of democracy.
I think you're absolutely right.
And we need to do the same kind of campaigns we do for everything else we need to do in voting and citizenship.
And I would suggest that prior to turning 18, it's a requirement. Just like getting your driver license, you have to go through this, that, and the other. Yeah. Then before you get to, and then at the end of this civic engagement, you get to register to vote. But you're informed about what it means, how we started as a country, what local, national, city elections mean. And then here's your opportunity to register to vote. And how would you like
right.
to?
Right. Like the Secret Service, like when I was a teenager, I had to register for the Secret Service when I was 18 years old. Selective service.
Yeah, me too. And you know what? It's funny because today at a voting place, somebody came out and they told a candidate she wasn't on the ballot, and she flipped out and she went in to, you know, the centralized voting place that I was working at. And we're like, this is terrible. The candidate's name isn't on the ballot. And it turns out after research, they found out she was a ward candidate that the guy didn't know what ward he lived in.
So
he thought he lived in Ward 3, but he really lives in Ward 4. So, you know, there was all this hullabaloo over this, you know, because the woman's like, what do you mean you couldn't vote for me? And he said, nope, your name wasn't on the ballot. The race was not on the ballot. And she went in a race, holy hell, and the guy comes down and says, look, this is his address. He lives in Ward 4, not in Ward 3. So, you know, you're right. We need a lot of education. Well, Earl, folks, you have been an amazing guest.
Not that
I had any doubt at all.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back very, very soon. And America, we will talk to you next week. I'm going to give Maria the last word, but we're going to leave you with a song in honor of our guest today. We're going to leave you with Everyday People by Sly and the Family Stone, because that's really what it's all about.
Okay, excellent.
All everyday people.
And
thank you, Earl.
Michael and Earl, I'd like to say not only thank you for your contribution to making this planet and our world a better place, but to our listeners who don't necessarily listen live but download us and listen on demand, we appreciate the privilege to be in your earbuds, because we know you've got lots of choices out there, and the fact that you consistently choose to hear what it is that we have to say and what we think is important to you is an honor and a privilege, and we're very grateful for that. So thank you.
Okay, we'll see you next week.
Yes,
thank you, Maria, for always saying what needs to be said.
Thank you. Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
Give the people their right to vote.